two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy 2024! New year, new you, right? Let me guess. You're thinking about joining a new gym, starting a fad diet, buying that Theragun everyone's always yammering on about. I've got a better idea. Listen to my podcast. I'm Samantha Bee, writer, comedian, and host of Choice Words from Lemonada Media. This whole month of January, we're going to help you make better choices in 2024. We'll go beyond superficial hacks and get at the truth of how to lead a more meaningful life. Just search for Choice Words on your podcast player of choice and hit follow so you don't miss an episode. Now that is a good choice.
Lemonada.
Certainly, we knew from the time we shut down our season in mid-March until when we started up again in early July in Orlando, several dozens of our players became infected with the virus, probably no different than other members of the public, particularly young people who were out and about. And so relative to the lives they were living, we know this is much safer. In fact, we've had zero positive cases since we started.
Welcome to In the Bubble, August 19th. This is Andy Slavitt.
And Zach.
The voice you just heard was Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA. They ran a very interesting experiment that we'll hear about on this show. And that experiment should be encouraging because I think it should show us that with the right planning, you can actually exist in a safe way and open things up. But you have to plan for it. And that's what they did. And it's something called In the Bubble. Funny enough. Let's stop and take stock a little bit. We have made it through the middle of August. We're about maybe not quite 6 months into the pandemic. You know, things started kind of really being visible in March. We had a horrible losses in April. The country opened up in May and really let its guard down. The federal government stopped, for all matter speaking, doing the work we all needed and that we would need to be ready in the fall. June, cases started to hit in the South. July, we started to see the death rate climb again to the point where here we are in August. 170,000 Americans have lost their lives. There's been over 5 million cases of coronavirus. And for many people, it doesn't feel like there's an end in sight. And through it all, you have been going through whatever you've been going through. Challenges, I'm sure. I know this year has not looked like or felt like what you wanted it to when we entered the year, whether you're an essential worker, whether you know people who have lost their jobs, whether you have family members who you've lost, whether you've been sick, whether you've just been scared, whether you've had anxiety or depression, whether or not you have missed people in your lives. I'm sure all of those things are true for many folks. And hopefully you've had some good moments too, some positive moments. Maybe they're learnings that you learned about yourself. Maybe you learned some things about the country. Some were good, some were bad. But, you know, when we started the show, our first episode was April 1st. We've now, believe it or not, put out 42 episodes, counting today. I'm both proud of the work we've done, but also really grateful to be able to talk to all of you. And I've said it so much, I'm tired of hearing myself say that we are trying to bring an ethic that has kind of a combination of Winston Churchill and Fred Rogers. And I realize I say that as much because I admire those two people and because they remind us that in times of crisis, there is strength, there is help, there is leadership, and it emerges from all kinds of places. And today's episode will be a different one because it is really about leadership that is coming from some unusual places. It's with somebody that I admire, Steve Kerr, who is a basketball coach with the Golden State Warriors. if that turns you off because you're not a sports fan, I would also want you to just at least hear the beginning of the conversation where you hear about Steve's very unusual biography and very tragic part of his life and how that's colored him. And, you know, in some ways, Steve is in the tradition of Muhammad Ali and Bill Walton and other sports figures who speaks up for what he believes in. He's also going to talk about a little bit about something else that I think is critical to this moment, which is what leaders can model. The NBA is modeling the bubble, which they've stole from our show. But they're modeling the bubble, and they're modeling some other things. And to talk about one of those things, I'm going to actually, Zach, why don't you talk about one of those things?
Okay. Just 4 days ago, the FDA approved saliva-based COVID-19 test. And this was developed by Yale and the NBA's tests over the last couple of months that, of course, you were involved in. And basically, the test is considered to be somewhere around 90% accurate and takes about 30 minutes at first and potentially faster eventually, I think. And it's going to cost somewhere around $10. But I think the biggest question is, when will just pretty much anybody be able to get one of these whenever they want?
Yeah, I think, so what's interesting is what Yale and the NBA did, and I was fortunate enough to be involved with it, is they did this on an open source basis, which means instead of baking a bunch of pizzas that people had to stand in line for and that you could run out of ingredients, they basically just created a pizza recipe that they got approved and said, you can use whatever ingredients you want as long as they work. So that it may take a little longer to get through those labs in the process, but it means any lab in the country will be able to offer this test. And because the ingredients are cheap and they're interchangeable, you don't run into the same kind of supply chain issues. And then, of course, you know, you just have to think of a tasty food and then spit into a test tube and it gets sent away and you can get the results more quickly. What's nice about it is you can do it much more frequently because a $10 test versus a $100 test, we're now on the road to being able to get back to being able to get tested whenever we want to and to more normal life. We're actually going to have a whole episode, a toolkit episode on how testing is going to change things and what's coming, but that'll be in a few weeks.
You said we're on the road, but when do you think that happens?
Well, I think it's going to come in stages. Right now we have these big, huge, expensive tests, and they're really well designed for people who are sick. But we need our two more types of tests. This is one of them. This is a test for largely designed for people who are asymptomatic. So you can test 100 people in an NBA area, or you can, or 500 people in a school, and it can be done very cheaply, and you can get the results very quickly. There's a third type of test that we need, and that's a more of a paper-based, home-based test, which will not be as accurate, but be very cheap, and people can do it themselves. That third type of test, you know, we're still a couple months away from.
Cool. Good news.
Now let's get to Steve Kerr. He is a former NBA basketball player with the Chicago Bulls. He is the Golden State Warriors head coach in the NBA, and he's become an outspoken advocate for social justice. I want to get to some of the things going on in the NBA right now because they are such a an interesting kind of role the NBA has been playing in the pandemic. But then maybe just start by introducing you a little bit better to folks who don't know you, which is hard for me to imagine because, you know, you've been a household name in my life since you started playing basketball. But you've had a very interesting and storied and life with also a little bit of sadness in it, too, for people who don't know. I'm wondering if you're willing to just give a couple minutes on where and how you grew up, and people can just know you a little bit better.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I'm well known in basketball circles, but not really in other circles. So that makes perfect sense. You know, so just to give any of your listeners who are not familiar with my story a little background. I'm a coach of the Golden State Warriors. I played in the NBA for 15 years. I grew up in Los Angeles. My dad was a professor at UCLA, and he was a professor of Middle East history and politics. And so we spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I was actually born in Beirut, where my dad grew up and went to graduate school and met my mom. My mom was on her junior year abroad from Occidental College. That's where they met. And so we have a long family history in Beirut that I won't go into, but for the most part, spent my childhood in Los Angeles as a big UCLA basketball fan, which was a great time to be a UCLA fan, because those were the John Wooden years, you know, during the dominance of that program. So that's where I fell in love with basketball, and my family was very academically minded. I'm the only person in my family who went into sports, but I've got three siblings, and two of them are PhDs, and the other one's an MBA, and everybody's doing great. But we were hit with the devastation of losing our dad to terrorism in 1984. He was the president of the American University of Beirut. He left his job at UCLA and took that job in Beirut, which was his dream job since he was a young student. And he was assassinated by two gunmen outside of his office. It was kind of the early stages of Middle East terrorism against Americans. And that obviously changed our lives forever and has served as a kind of a backdrop in many ways for my story and, you know, my own evolution as a person and as a coach and as a human being. So even though I'm mainly a basketball coach, I mean, that's my job, and I'm mainly interested in basketball. I do have a real interest in world events and politics, and I have been relatively outspoken about certain things here and there, sometimes controversially, and here we are, and somehow I got an invitation to your podcast.
Yeah. Well, you and I are about the same age. I think you were born in, what, 65? And I was born in 66.
Yeah.
I lost my dad, not as dramatically and as tragically and sadly as you lost your dad, but when he was pretty young too. I just know how colored you are by thinking about carrying on the legacy of someone you admire so deeply. This was like a couple years ago. You probably passed the age he was when he passed away. Was that an event for you? I mean, did that register for you? Do you think about how in your life kind of carries on some of the things that he started?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the biggest thing is just remembering his voice and his mannerisms and the way he carried himself, and recognizing a lot of those things in my siblings and myself. And so you understand going through something like this, and obviously everybody does at some point. You know, we all go through loss. We all go through death. In our families, it's just a question of when. But I think it's apparent to all of us that when you love someone who's had such a huge impact on your life, that person's legacy carries on in you forever. And so that's a very comforting thought, actually, for me. And when I read stories about my dad, or someone tells me a story, it's really nice. You know, it's even though there are a lot of painful memories, there are a lot of great memories too.
Yeah. I think people who haven't lost a parent yet don't appreciate how much, at least for me, a lot of us actually like to be reminded and have the conversation and to keep the memory alive and to have those thoughts. And I decided actually, instead of reading up on you, who I know quite a bit about, to just read about your dad as much as I could over the last couple of days. And an amazing person, an amazing legacy that you're carrying on.
Oh, thank you. Last week, Tom Friedman wrote a column in the New York Times about kind of the current state of affairs in American politics. And the opening paragraph recounted a story of Tom being at the dinner table with my dad in Beirut in like 1983. 1982. And the story was kind of captured my dad's humor and some of his wit and the way he looked at the world and kind of poked fun at things. And, um, And I read Tom Friedman's columns all the time because I think he's great. And he has just an incredible knowledge of the Middle East and a great perspective. And I had no idea that this article mentioned my dad until I opened it up. And there it was. And it was like wow. Sent shockwaves through my body. But it was cool. Really heartwarming to read that story just randomly about my dad.
That's great. Well, may his name get said over and over and over again. Again, I can't imagine how he would feel about you and what you have accomplished. Not just, you know, you talked about the fact that you are a basketball coach and former player, but you left out a couple details like having one of the league records for, and which, you know, like 10 people in the world do. You happen to have the record for three-point shooting, and you have left out the fact that you have like more championship rings than just about anybody since the 60s in the Celtics. And we're part of some really phenomenal teams. But not just that. I think, you know, we look at sport as sometimes it's a distraction for us. It's an event. It has some importance. But it's sort of, you know, you're not always clear what role it plays in society. And it's in some cases, particularly when you've got leagues that don't set great examples. But the NBA has developed a couple of interesting attributes that I'm wondering if you can reflect on for us. One is that... you seem to have embraced racial justice in a way, in a more overt, in a more clear way. Second is there are characters in our history going back, you know, to Muhammad Ali that carry over to people like Bill Walton and LeBron James and yourself, who I put very much in this category of people who won't be quiet when you see injustice. So I'm curious if you can reflect on, is that a purposeful, natural fit with who the NBA is and who the NBA wants to be? Is that an uncomfortable fit?
I think it's a very comfortable fit, given the NBA management and ownership has always been extremely supportive of its players. And that began really with David Stern years ago, and it's continued with Adam Silver, the current commissioner. But there was always a sense of collaboration. And we had our share of you know, union labor disputes, and there were a couple lockouts and things like that. But there was always a sense of unity within the NBA. It's also, you know, a very urban game. I believe 80% of the players in the NBA are Black. So you have the dynamics that are in place where you've got a fan base that appreciates the beauty of the game, appreciates and has always appreciated the access to the players. You know, unlike other sports, our players are out front and center, and no other sport can you see the emotion right in front of you. You know, no helmets, no face masks. And so all of these things, you put everything combined, and you see the incredible athleticism and the beauty of the sport. And I think it's very natural for the NBA to have come to this place where we are right now as a country and where the league is in the fight for social justice.
And now you can get to hear Zach and me talk, paid for by someone else.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts between Julia Louis-Dreyfus and her A-plus guests on Wiser Than Me, laugh along with Elise Myers as she and her guests play a rapid-fire questions game on Funny 'Cause It's True, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
So how do you see your role in all this and in the NBA? On the one hand, you know, you're a coach, so you know, you're the guy on the bench who's in charge. Although, you know, increasingly with some of these players, it's not always clear whether the coach is in charge anymore. But also, you know, you're white. You're one of the, as you said, you're one of the 20%. So you're an ally to both your players and to other coaches and other people of color throughout the league. And yet you've taken to, I think, this role which says we can't, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but we can't leave it to people to fight all their own battles without support, without other people fighting their battles and seeing the world through their eyes.
Yeah, I just think that it's important for those of us who have a platform and who see things that are wrong in our society, things that we can do better in our country. It's important for us to speak up. You know, in a democracy, that's, you know, that's our right, you know, the right of free speech. But it's more than that. It's the only way we can really achieve any success long term is to call attention to these things. I've read a lot about different coaches in basketball history, and one of the guys I love is Dean Smith. I only met him a couple of times, played against him when I was at Arizona and he was coaching North Carolina. But, you know, he very famously stood up for his black players in his early days at North Carolina, I believe in the 60s, where, you know, they went to the South. A hotel wouldn't allow the black players to stay at that hotel. He was one of the first coaches really to put up a big fight and say, no, this is not right. And we're not coming here anymore. We're not playing here anymore. They would literally leave, stay at a different hotel, or cancel the game, whatever he felt was necessary. And that helped the process along. And I just think it's important for any of us who have a platform to, if we see something, it's important to call it out and to try to continue this incremental progress that we can make.
You're through the league, is there any side eye when Steve Kerr puts a tweet out which says, hey, I think this is wrong. I think it's wrong that Americans are being deprived of the right to vote in certain places or supporting Black Lives Matter or something? Are there people who say, you know, God, Steve, stick to basketball. What are you doing here? Or is it now at a point where it is becoming part of the brand of the league?
The world that we live in, of course, there are people who are going to express their displeasure. You know, the people who I know, the people who I work with, everybody's very supportive. But, you know, this is, we could get into a much deeper conversation. You know, this is largely what is wrong with social media is, you know, it encourages this sort of non-confrontational insulting that goes back and forth, right? And things that you would never say face to face, you just feel really comfortable typing behind your keyboard or your phone, and it's really unhealthy. And the reality is, the only way you can accomplish anything in life is through collaboration. You know, no matter what you're trying to accomplish, you've got to be able to work through problems. And actually having people with different viewpoints is a very healthy thing, as long as you go through the process and, you know, you kind of understand each other's points of views and you come to a good conclusion. That's a sort of a normal way of working through a problem. But our current state of affairs doesn't really allow us to ever get to that point.
Yeah. Well, I would give you a little bit of feedback, which I hope you've heard before, but I have witnessed kids who feel a little braver and a little more comfortable being able to do the right thing, looking out for teammates or others who are getting some level of discrimination. And it's like, oh, Steve Kerr speaks out. And, you know, I think there's a football player in the NFL named Chris Long, who I think also, you know, he, for those who don't know, he took a knee alongside some of the NFL players. He's a white player. And by doing that, by taking the stand that I've seen you take, I have literally seen younger people feel like they can do that.
That's nice to know. And I think I do feel that. And I know that at some level, because otherwise I would probably just, you know, stop tweeting. And there are days, there are many days where I think, you know what, maybe I should just give up this Twitter stuff. And then I always come back around to, I can't, I have to speak the truth. And that's, I think that's the, that's really what is, I think at the core of a lot of people's angst is this assault on the truth, this assault on facts that we're hearing from our president's mouth every day and from a large portion of our population. Just the truth has to matter. The facts have to matter. And so I think it's important for people to speak their mind.
Yeah. I mean, you know, here we sit. See, if I'd told you a year ago that, you know, we'd have lost 160,000 Americans, that we'd be in the middle of an election where there'd be very active above the surface efforts to prevent people from being able to vote, with such a tremendous sense of loss, people not feeling like there's anyone taking accountability, and asking them the question, and I think part of what I wanted to have you on the show is, a lot of the question people ask is, where's leadership going to come from? Because I can't do this on my own. There's a lot of things I can do on my own. People want me to bootstrap. I bootstrap the best I can. There's a global pandemic. How the hell do I bootstrap my way through that? And they're trying to take away my right to vote. And the blatant injustices are just right in my face.
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. And we definitely all hope that leadership will emerge in Washington and that people will be looked after with a safety net that is so desperately needed right now in terms of having enough money to pay your rent and buy food and have health care, just the basics, just to get, you know, first to get people through this time, but then to hopefully create some change in this country that was already needed before any of this started. So the hope is maybe some of that would come through an election. But short of that, I think it's probably important to look at other people, you know, whether it's a teacher, a coach, local government, I think is really important. Sometimes, you know, people get lost in the shuffle. Everyone gets so wrapped up in national politics, but local politics really impact your own community more than national politics do. And the community you're in, there are leaders within those communities, and it's important to engage with each other to sort of try to lift each other up and lift those leaders up to positions where they can actually get some things done.
So let's talk about the recent events in the NBA. So from your view, you were going through leading the team through an uncharacteristically not so great season. You'd won gobs and gobs of championships, and this was probably not going to be the year. And then all of a sudden, Rudy Gobert, who is a player of the league, gets diagnosed with coronavirus. And a few days later, the league announces that it's suspending its season. Can you talk about how that hit you? Were you surprised? What was the buzz? What were the players saying?
Yeah, I mean, this was a strange season for us. Anyway, you know, we had a ton of injuries, and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, our two guards, both missed the entire season. Two of the best players in the NBA, and at the time of the suspension in March, we had the worst record in the NBA. So it was a tough go as it was. But when word of the pandemic came about, you know, kind of in January. Actually, my son was the first one to really alert me of the potential of the devastation. He has a master's in public health. He said, you know, this could be a real problem. And I said, we took care of SARS. We took care of, H1N1. I mean, we'll get through this. Ebola. He said, no. He took a couple classes in pandemics. And he said, if it gets out of control, it could really, really mess the world up. And all of a sudden, as you said, Rudy Gobert of the Jazz, Utah Jazz, gets sick, and Adam Silver, the commissioner, suspends the league. Everything stops, and we're all just kind of sitting there like, what the hell just happened? And it all just hit so quickly, because even though we kind of knew, we were all reading about this potential, that's when it hit home. That's when it really hit home that it was real.
It was real. And the country froze.
For everybody, yeah.
Don't go anywhere. We've got to go earn some money to donate to charity.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Dough, where cash is queen and we hardly know her, but we're still here figuring her out together because, y'all, season two is here. Hosted every week by me, X-Maya. Remember me? I'm going to be talking to all types of people about their relationship to money. I'm talking to reality stars, entrepreneurs, financial experts, and even some of my own friends. Basically, anyone who will get real with me about their dollars, how they make money, how they spend it, and how they save it, because I'm trying to retire early, people. Season two of The Dough is out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The NBA has created a bubble. Which, by the way, since we're called In the Bubble, I'm suing the league over. So just so you know, no, I'm kidding. I didn't trademark it in time. But so you guys created a bubble. And in many respects, I think the NBA took the view that we can be a microcosm for how to live with this virus, not just freeze our life permanently, but you spent a bunch of time created a bunch of protocols, which I was actually involved with some of the creation of, to say, what if we show we could do this? And maybe there's some lessons here and some examples here in, that can be mirrored in schools and that could be mirrored in universities and other places to show that you can live with this virus if you're very, very careful and adopt some strategies. And then this week, the NBA, in working with Yale, announced a brand new, very low cost, very quick test that the NBA Players Union and the NBA helped to pay for and design the protocol. Those could be enormous contributions from how a sport contributes to society.
Yeah, they could be. And I don't want to give the impression that, this effort was, this altruistic, endeavor just to save the world. I mean, this NBA is a huge business. So the first part of this is, how can we keep the season going so that we can actually generate the revenue that's needed to pay the bills and pay the players and, get games on TV. And so the owners and the league management put their heads together and at the very beginning, and I was not on these calls. I mean, coaches are not on these calls, but general managers are, and our general manager, Bob Myers, he shared a lot of thoughts about what was happening, and it just seemed like this gargantuan task to try to, from March 12th when the suspension happened until, I guess, July 1st or so when the games, or July 28th actually was when the games started again. The amount of work that went into putting together this bubble, the amount of detail was incredible, and I heard you mention you were part of the process, and it's been an amazing success story. I mean, they haven't had a single positive case, and I think in putting this bubble together and in looking at all the details and in being really resilient and forceful in the implementation of all the regulations, the league has shown people what's possible for sure.
Yeah.
And it's really something that we're all very proud of. Having said that, nobody wants to do a 9-month season in a bubble next year, but for the time being, this is a really great thing that the league has done.
Robbie Sika, who is a Timberwolves VP of performance, literally was up 24/7 working across with the league to create a test that could be taken There was an easy way to do it for the league, and there was a way to do it that was a little bit harder for the league, but better for everybody else. I think with the full cooperation of the league, he chose that path, and that path is going to essentially mean that we're going to have a $4 or $5 test that people can take using saliva because the league players just decided to do that. And so I believe when the history of this era is written, there'll be some interesting bookends that the NBA will be very much a part of. Both what happened with Rudy Gobert, which turned out to be an incredible blessing, as kind of crazy as that moment was, the fact that the league shut down when it did and it got everybody else to pay attention, so many lives were saved. And then here, I think the NBA has given parts of society a map for how to come out of this thing, how to live through this thing. And I think it's a fascinating way to think about a sports league.
Yeah. And as I said, it's something that we're really proud of, you know, because this whole thing has been so confusing. If you're just, you know, normal guy just trying to take care of your family and keep everybody safe and healthy, the amount of conflicting advice and information has been so overwhelming. And so it's been really nice to just see the NBA kind of just be really straightforward and say, here's what we're doing, and here's why, and here's who we're partnering with, and this is what we believe. And then they go ahead and they do it. And there's a few stragglers, right? A couple of guys, you know, broke the bubble rule, and then they had to re-quarantine. And here we are past, I guess we're about 6 weeks into the bubble without a single case. And so there's no question. It's proof. It's proof of what's possible, what can happen if we put our minds to it in other ways, in other areas, whether it's schools, businesses, whatever.
Yeah. And look, I would just say this. The goal is not zero cases. The goal is not eradication. I mean, it's not like this. Like the goal is not zero heart attacks or zero knee injuries. But what you want to do is you want to prevent one from becoming 1,000. And with an infectious disease, if you can wrap your arms around it, whether it's because people are in a geographic area that's enclosed or because you're testing every day and you're not in a geographic area that's enclosed, but you catch it before you go, oh, wow, that happened to me 10 days ago and I was around 10,000 people. So the individual case here and there, I want people to see not as a failure, but as a success. And the way countries around the world measure this is what percentage of cases happen where you are the terminal person, not terminal as in dead, but when you are the terminal case, in other words, you don't pass it along to anybody else. And in the US, we don't even measure that number, but it's probably about 2-3%. In the rest of the world, in Europe, it's 75-80%, because you catch the case and you say, got it, we're going to isolate you and we're going to take care of you.
And that's because we're not doing the contact tracing. Is it because of we're not testing as much as well? Because that's one thing that we always hear is how much testing we're now doing. I mean, according to our president. Yeah. So that's my question for you. Is our testing now up to speed? And if so, then where are we going wrong?
It's not. Right now, we're doing a lot more tests than we used to do. But unfortunately, cases grew much faster. And so the labs plateaued. So we estimate there are probably 10 times as many cases per day as get tests. And right now, most labs around the country have 7 or 8 days turnaround time. And Steve, you had a 7 or 8 day turnaround time. It's like, I'll tell you the outcome of the game in 8 days. It does you no good to find out 8 days later. So in many respects, we have no visibility into this. It also is contact tracing. Testing somebody is one thing, but if you can't contact trace and isolate people, that doesn't do you any good. But all this comes down to there's really been no national effort and no national strategy here like there have been in other countries. And this is work. It's like everything else. It takes work. You got to put in the work. You can't just snap your fingers and say, this is going to happen.
Right.
So I don't want to take too much advantage of your time. Well, we'll let you go, but I have to ask you this. I'm sure you asked these questions 1,000 times, and let's see if you may dodge them or you may answer them. But Bulls in the league today, 90s Bulls, you're on the team playing the Warriors of last year or the year before. How does it go?
Yeah, I have been asked this a lot.
I'm sure you are.
Yeah, And
do you dodge it or do you answer it?
I mean, I would say that it would be interesting coaching against myself.
Yeah.
Number one, I would definitely, if Kerr the player were on the floor, I would definitely make him guard Steph Curry in a pick and roll because he'd have no chance. The unique thing about those Bulls teams to me is that we were built to actually play the modern game. The game's very different today. There's very few low post big guys. You know, back then you had the aircraft carrier guys down low, you know, Shaq and Patrick Ewing and David Robinson, Tim Duncan. And now it's like almost all guards and the rules are different too. But those Bulls teams, we had certain lineups that did not include me, by the way, that if I were on the bench, but if you had Ron Harper, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Tony Kukoc, and Dennis Rodman, that's a modern NBA team.
That's a modern
team.
Lineup.
It's a modern lineup, and that would have been an incredible modern NBA basketball team. So, yeah, that would have been fun to watch.
Which of you loved more, coaching or playing?
You know, there's nothing like playing. I mean, playing is the ultimate because, you know, that's what, as a kid, you don't grow up. Most people don't, and you know, you don't at 7 years old dream of being on the sidelines coaching a team. You know, you dream of making the shot that wins the game, and you'd shoot that shot in your driveway over and over again. And
which, by the way, you did.
I was fortunate enough to actually do that.
I may have been there.
Were you?
I may have been there.
Yeah, that was a thrill. The difference when I was a kid. If I missed that shot in my driveway, you know what I would do? I would pretend that I got fouled.
Right.
and then I would get two free throws. So didn't have that luxury this time. But I think playing is the ultimate, but coaching is the next best thing. And I really enjoy it.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Andy, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
All right, there's more with Steve Kerr, but it's about basketball. And I'm guessing there's better basketball podcasts than In the Bubble, although I doubt it. But we couldn't resist. I know that's not why you listen to us, but if you want to listen to a really great short conversation on basketball with Zach and Steve Kerr, we'll have it on Patreon. Just go on lemonadamedia.com, become a member. We thank you greatly. The money all goes to a good cause, and you can hear us talk basketball with Steve Kerr. Now let me tell you what's coming up next week. On Monday, we have our episode on the Republicans, and they're at the start of their convention. If you haven't heard the episode we just recorded on Monday on the Democrats, this is really talking about what are we going to see at the Republican convention and how might the reelection of Donald Trump impact the management of the coronavirus. Yes, something we should talk about. And we're going to talk about it with Bill Kristol, who is an incredible commentator, publisher, voice you've all heard before, and who has been a critic of President Trump's. And it's a very interesting interview. After that, we are going to have a conversation with Brian Cashman next Wednesday. So tune in for that. That is more an example of how we are managing the virus not so well at the moment. And then our schools toolkit, by very popular demand, as school starts in many places, both in person and online, we have Janice Jackson, the superintendent of the Chicago School District, and John King, the former Secretary of Education. Look forward to talking to you then. Thanks, and have a great rest of the week. Over and out. Thanks for listening to In the Bubble. Hope you rate us highly. We're a production of Lemonada Media. Chrissy Pease is our producer. Ivan Kuriev is our editor. Jessica Cordova Kramer and Stephanie Whittleswax executive produce the show and run our lives. My son Zach Slavitt is my cool co-host and on-site producer. Our theme was composed by Dan Malad and Oliver Hill, with additional music by Ivan Kuriev. You can find out more about our show on social media at Lemonada Media, and you can find me at A. Slavitt on Twitter or at Andy Slavitt on Instagram. If you liked what you heard today, please tell your friends to come listen, but tell them at a distance. And for now, stay safe, share some joy, and we will get through this together. And hashtag stay home.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere, and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people, and we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. I am Jose Andres. Maybe you know me from my restaurants or maybe from Wall Central Kitchen, the organization I founded to feed people after disasters. Well, it's time for you to know my podcast, Longer Tables. Each episode, I get to know fascinating people in the most intimate way. Through food. Stacey Abrams, Jojo Ma, Jane Goodall, Padma Lakshmi. I will answer questions from listeners too. Join me in building longer tables, not higher walls, whatever you get your podcasts.